Thanks very much. So it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Michael Crump. Many of you may be patients of his. Many of you may be John's patients, and it's wonderful if you are. I just wanted to say that Dr. Crump is internationally known for his work in lymphoma. I have the privilege of being able to call him and John, ask for advice, have him support us, and it's an absolute tremendous relationship to be able to work with him and have his support. Dr. Crump obtained his medical degree from the University of Toronto, and I'm not going to say what year, because yesterday at the conference you said you were the oldest in the room. I was going to stand up and say, no, you're not, because I am, but I didn't like winning that prize, quite frankly. He completed his training in internal medicine, hematology, and medical oncology in Toronto, and additional training in autologous stem cell transplant at U of T and Duke University in North Carolina. Dr. Crump is appointed to the Faculty of Medicine at U of T in 1992. His current research interests include clinical and translational research in lymphoma, with a focus on stem cell transplantation and development of novel therapies, as well as the late effects of that treatment. He's been the principal investigator and co-investigator for a number of clinical trials in lymphoma, and has also published a number of papers and chapters in books. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Mike Crump.
Is there a laser? Good morning, everyone. So it is almost afternoon, and I'll try not to talk into the afternoon. That's my goal. So I think when we were all charged with our topics, the instructions more or less looked the same, I think. And so there may be a little bit of repetition, and I'll try to make sure that I only do so when it's pertinent. But then again, people have said that sometimes repetition is important. So what are the aggressive lymphomas? So these are the sort of the official names of aggressive lymphoma. And the remarks I'm going to provide today are really probably just apply to these ones. I'm not going to specifically talk about Burkitt lymphoma, which is a special kind. I'm not going to talk about transformed lymphoma. Matt Chung and others are going to talk about how that happens in patients with indolent lymphoma. And is there anybody in the room with T-cell lymphoma? Well, T-cell lymphomas are aggressive lymphomas, and they probably deserve their own talk, or they certainly deserve their own treatments, but we'll skip past that. So the other two speakers have already said something about pathology, and I'm just going to reinforce, I think, what they said with a simpler slide, is that, when I was a boy, diagnosing lymphoma was just done by a pathologist looking down the microscope. But now we want to provide, if not patient-specific, if not personalized treatment, at least the right treatment, we need this other stuff, this immunohistochemistry that looks at proteins on the surface of the cell. We need to have information about the genetics of the lymphomas, because that's really where the differences is for sure in aggressive lymphomas are starting to shake out in terms of why does one kind of diffuse large cell lymphoma seem to do particularly well with chemotherapy and the other one doesn't, when they just looked exactly the same under the microscope to the pathologists. So I guess we can't really emphasize this point enough, that the lymphoma diagnostics are really important. So in terms of incidence, these are actually American figures, but the Canadian figures are roughly similar. So diffuse large cell lymphoma, which is kind of the signature aggressive lymphoma, that's what I'm going to talk mostly about, is the most common kind of lymphoma in adults. It's about twice as common as follicular lymphoma, and more common than many other types. So it's been an area of, it's not of public health importance. It's not as common as breast cancer or prostate cancer, but it's very important because it's a curable type of lymphoma, and we've learned a lot about their treatment. So the other thing that defines aggressive lymphoma, or that led us to call them that, is the clinical characteristics of this disease. So people with aggressive lymphomas tend to have a much shorter history. They don't have symptoms or enlarging lumps for very long. As compared to some of the other indolent lymphomas where people commonly report having lymph nodes, or Hodgkin lymphoma where people have had lymph nodes for come and go for a long time. And generally, people with aggressive lymphomas need to be treated at the time of diagnosis. I'm sure if you've waited for your family doctor to send you to a surgeon, and you've waited for the surgeon to do the biopsy, and you've waited for the appointment to come and see the doctor, you want to be treated immediately. Because you've already had cancer for as long as you want to think about it. But truly, some people who have, so we get it. When we see people, you're ready to start, and we want to be ready to start too. But some people need to be admitted to the hospital and treated right away. Most people, certainly within a short period of time, we have to get our act together, we have to get all the tests done, we have to come up with the right diagnosis and the right treatment plan. And we do that in a relatively short period of time, we hope. And the other distinguishing feature is generally the expectation here is that patients will go into remission, the lymphoma will disappear, the symptoms will go away, and as John said in his talk, that at least sets the stage for thinking about whether or not people could be cured, but you have to live for the rest of your life without having your lymphoma come back, of course, for that to be true. But that's what the goal is potentially for this group of lymphomas, that they are curable. So not to harp too much on the pathology bit again, but we hope that if you have aggressive lymphoma, somebody's talked to you about the importance of some of these details, because these pathological details are really important. They form the criteria for the diagnosis, and they also shape treatment. So, for example, there's a type of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma called primary mediastinal lymphoma. And it has unique features, and we think it's very important for patients with that type of lymphoma to receive radiation at the end of their treatment. Not everybody with aggressive lymphoma needs radiation nor benefits from it, but we think that this group of patients do, and I'll leave it to Richard Tsang to say more about that. A very simple pathological test now is to test whether or not lymphoma cells express this protein called CD20. It tells us that it's a B cell, but it also tells us that one of the first targeted therapy we have in lymphoma, rituximab, an antibody that is directed against that protein, is going to be an important part of the treatment. So you can't just look down the microscope to find this. You've got to do the testing in a reliable way. As I said, T cell lymphomas can look the same under the microscope until the immunohistochemistry is done, and then the natural history of those lymphomas is quite different. The treatments are changing as well. As I said, Burkitt lymphoma has a special chromosomal change in it, and we can really only confidently say that somebody has Burkitt lymphoma if we see that chromosome change, it requires specific testing. So if you're wondering why it's taking so long for the pathologist to report on your lymphoma, it's because they're trying to do all of this other stuff to make sure that the diagnosis is accurate, or as accurate as they can make it, and we need the information in terms of deciding on treatment. So sometimes, because lymphoma pathology is complicated and sophisticated, we think it's worth the wait. We're just trying to make the wait, just like you, we're trying to make the waiting time shorter. We're trying to move things along. And then again, pathology also reflects on what kind of staging tests might be relevant. So both Peter and John have talked about staging and what stage is. But certain types of lymphoma require either more or less staging, depending on what the types are. So there may be reasons why we'd have to do a lumbar puncture to look at the spinal fluid in somebody with aggressive histology lymphoma. Most of the time, patients with aggressive lymphoma will have a bone marrow biopsy to look for staging. Sometimes, actually, we skip it because there are certain circumstances where it's not relevant or it's not going to change treatment and it's just uncomfortable. And then the nuclear medicine tests that both John and Peter talked about are going to be relevant in some circumstances or more relevant in some circumstances than another. So it all kind of gets back on the shoulders of the pathologist. They're probably happy that they're not here today to endure scrutiny. And the value of all of this splitting rather than lumping is that it actually, not only are these lymphomas different, they have different prognosis. So even with the same treatment, we can tell you more or less, we can tell you a lot more about the prognosis of your lymphoma if we have an accurate picture of the pathological details. So it's important for you to know what kind of lymphoma you have. Obviously. So it all does start with a biopsy. and if you get sent back, so this is my version of what John had already talked about, that we really can't give proper treatment as much as our surgical colleagues would like us to be able to do that just with cells from a fine needle aspiration. So we try to hurry along the surgeons and the pathologists because we need this extra information that either a removal of a lymph node or a core biopsy done by radiologists using CT or ultrasound, this is the tissue that they need. They need as much as possible in order to be definitive. I've had many patients say, do I definitely have this kind of, do I definitely have diffuse large? Can you tell me 100% that this is what it is? And the answer to that is, yeah, we often can. But even sometimes with the removal of a lymph node, people are not going to be 100% definitive. But we're going to get as close as we need to get in order to make the right treatment choice. So this is just a reminder that we are talking about lymph nodes and know your nodes is a Lymphoma Society slogan. And certainly aggressive histology lymphomas, the aggressive types of lymphoma, can show up as a lump in the neck or above the collarbone or in the groin. It can show up in all of those places. But this kind of lymphoma also arises in a bunch of parts of the body that are not lymph nodes, such as the stomach. It's probably the most common part of the GI tract. It can be in the bone marrow, but the liver and the skin, a whole bunch of other places that are actually not lymph nodes. In fact, maybe a third of patients with aggressive histology lymphomas are not diagnosed because they had a lymph node biopsy, but because the lymphoma has shown up somewhere else. But as it happens, in general, the treatment approaches and the treatment outcomes for patients who have lymphoma that presents at an extranodal site, the stomach, the skin, etc., is not much different than it is for patients who have a presentation in a typical fashion. So the other speakers have already covered all of this. We do scans of everything from the ears down, pretty much. It's not necessarily to have a scan of your brain unless somebody has symptoms suggesting that there's something going on in the brain, because involvement of the brain with this particular group of lymphomas is not very common. So we need to know what things are like at the beginning so we can actually tell whether or not treatments have worked at the end. We compare the first set of scans to the last set of scans to decide whether or not people are in remission. At least that's the first pass. And the staging tests are also obviously pretty important if we're thinking that the lymphoma is localized and we want to apply both radiation and chemotherapy, combined modality treatment. We need to be as certain as we can that there's no lymphoma anywhere else. Although there's a lot of concern about radiation exposure, we like to think that we prescribe or recommend just the right amount of radiation exposure. You only have as many scans as you need. And we talk to patients at the end of their treatment about getting rid of the superfluous scans, the ones that you don't need. But there is radiation exposure with the CT scan, the information is extremely valuable. I mentioned that not everybody needs to have a bone marrow biopsy, or at least we're not going to change treatment in some patients' circumstances if they have a bone marrow. There may be some circumstances where the bone marrow is reliably going to be negative, and we may choose to omit it. But on the other hand, in patients with T-cell lymphoma or other types of aggressive lymphomas, the bone marrow is frequently involved, and it's pretty important to know that ahead of time. There are some patients where the risk of lymphoma seeding the spinal fluid around the brain or seeding the brain itself is a realistic possibility. It doesn't happen very often at the time of diagnosis. But as I said before, anybody who's got symptoms that suggest there might be something happened in their brain would certainly get an MRI and then a lumbar puncture to look at the spinal fluid. But this would be the minority of people with aggressive lymphomas. Did something wrong. Excuse me. So Peter has already talked about the functional imaging tests. So I won't say too much about that. We don't use PET scans in aggressive lymphomas, or PET scans and gallium scans are not that helpful as far as telling us where the lymphoma is. We think the anatomy that's described, the geography of where a person's lymphoma is, is pretty adequately described by a CT scan and a bone marrow test. But occasionally, a PET scan can clarify an area that's we're not sure on a CT scan. It's more important in patients who are going to have combined modality treatment. The main role is to make sure that we understand whether or not the lymphoma has actually responded. So I'm not sure if you can see from the back, but this is somebody with a very big lymphoma in the middle of their chest, primary mediastinal large cell lymphoma. And we tell people at the end, with that particular diagnosis, at the end of your treatment, there's going to be something left on your CT scan. It's not going to be a normal CT scan. And lo and behold, there's still a little lump. If you can see it at the back, there's a gray spot at the end of the arrow. So we don't know if that's lymphoma or not. We're pretty sure with that particular type of lymphoma that it's not. There's a lot of scar tissue and extra stuff that goes along with the tumor cells, so that scar tissue just takes a long time to go away, longer than we want to wait with the imaging. So a PET scan or a CT scan, if it shows, as Peter mentioned, if this gray smudge here doesn't take up glucose or it doesn't take up gallium, we're pretty comfortable that we're just looking at the carcasses of your tumor cell. We don't have to be concerned that the treatment hasn't worked. Just stop leaning on the keyboard. So this would be an example of the of what the images would look like, gray stuff underneath the arms of somebody with lymphoma. These lumps here that are in the red circle are not supposed to be there. Those are enlarged lymph nodes. And they show up the black spots. You can see there's no enlarged lymph nodes on this side. There's no black spots on this side of the gallium scan, but these black spots under the pointer here are all uptake. So we can kind of match them up and say that's where we're going to, this is all lymphoma, and we do the gallium scan at the end. If all of those black spots go away, if the right side here starts to look like the left side at the end, we declare that the treatment has worked. So that's kind of, those are the things we look at when we're talking about this. So Peter and John had mentioned prognostic indices, and those are pretty important things in the discussion about outcomes in aggressive lymphomas. We actually used to use this IPI score that includes performance status, the impact of the lymphoma on the person, or maybe sometimes this performance status measure is actually a measure of other medical problems that people can have, but how people are, how sick are you when you're diagnosed with lymphoma? That has a pretty profound impact on expectations about response and what the toxicity is going to be like and what the outcomes are going to be like in the end. Counting up all these extra nodal sites of disease, that has an important prognostic meaning. We do a blood test called LDH that reflects the amount of lymphoma in the body. Fast-growing tumors that are very big, LDH levels are quite high. And age, unfortunately, the only thing that I've gained as I got older was wisdom. Outcomes, and I hope a bit of that, outcomes are not as good in older people, even when all these other things are equal. So this index, we actually once upon a time planned clinical trials, and in certain parts of the world that index is actually used to funnel patients off in one treatment direction or another. So when bone marrow transplantation as part of primary therapy was something that was actively investigated, it was only patients that had a lot of these risk factors that were enrolled in those clinical trials. They had the highest risk lymphoma and had the most perhaps to gain from a risky treatment like a transplant. But now we would use this information really to guide the discussion about what your expectations for treatment from treatment are going to be and what realistically they should be. So this is a distillation of about 35 years of lymphoma chemotherapy clinical trials research. This is the treatment for aggressive histology lymphomas. It's called CHOP. And that's just the acronym for all of the chemotherapy drugs that are used. So this regimen was actually published in the mid-70s. And it's not like we've been standing around doing nothing, okay? Like, things have happened since the 70s. But this is what everyone uses for aggressive histology lymphoma. It's three chemotherapy drugs given every 3 weeks, 5 days of prednisone. And there's a number of durations of this treatment that depend on circumstance. So, for example, if radiation is going to be used, the disease is localized, you might only get 4 cycles of treatment. There's some circumstances where people will get 8 cycles of treatment. So 8 times 3 weeks is 6 months. Like, why are we so certain this is the right thing to do? Why haven't we done something better than this? And the answer is there have been about 40 comparisons of CHOP to a bunch of other stuff. When there was no targeted therapy, when there was no antibody therapy, when I was a boy, that's what people did. We compared different chemotherapy regimens. And CHOP was always as good as all those other fancy, longer, more intensive chemotherapy regimens with more drugs, but it was less toxic. It was lower mortality rate from the treatment. So in the end, when two things are the same in medicine, we kind of pick the one that's not as hard on you. Even if it sounds like being aggressive sounds like a good idea, I've been told I have aggressive histology lymphoma, I should have an aggressive chemotherapy regimen. That has not translated into better outcomes. So we're trying to do things in a more subtle and sophisticated way. So even the number of cycles of chemotherapy has been compared. So we know that in most people, especially people over the age of 60, there isn't really any added value to giving 8 cycles. Everybody probably benefits maximally with just 6. So that's less doxorubicin and less vomiting and less everything else. And we've also studied the intervals. We thought for a while that maybe giving the chemotherapy more often was a better thing to do. And that's probably not so true anymore now that we're using rituximab. So 6 cycles given every 3 weeks really is kind of what most people would benefit optimally from, at least for the B-cell lymphomas. So we weren't layabouts for 35 years, but the thing that made the difference, this would be the typical comparison, this is the last time, 4 chemotherapy recipes, you can't read them from the back, but this is the 6 to 9 drug comparison versus 4 drugs. The outcomes for the patients is exactly the same. the thing that made a difference was adding this antibody, this anti-CD20 antibody, rituximab, to chemotherapy. The French were the first to show there was an improvement in survival by adding rituximab. So all they did was just add rituximab every time people got chemotherapy. Peter's already alluded to the science of all this, and we won't talk about it a lot, but it targets a protein on the outside of a B cell. We don't even know what the protein does. But we know that the antibody makes the chemotherapy more effective. It causes more cell killing if you do animal experiments or lab experiments. We can see that something good is happening inside the cell to kill more cancer cells, but really we're not sure what CD20 expression means. But this is, I'll just show you, this is your tax dollars at work. Because in the early, I guess the mid-2000s, rituximab was approved by the Ontario government. It was added to, now everybody gets it if you have CD20 on your lymphoma and you have aggressive histology B-cell lymphoma. It's routinely applied. So we did a population-based study. This is about 4,000 patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma treated over a number of years. And the top line is the survival outcome of the patients who received rituximab with the CHOP. And these are the patients who were treated prior to approval. And in young people and in older people, and even in very elderly patients, patients over the age of 79, 80 years plus, there's an improvement in survival. So your tax dollars at work, it's actually made a difference. So this is the largest population-based study to look at what the impact of rituximab on outcome has been. So it's been quite favorable. Now we need something else. Like, so this is fine. We need to keep going, and Rena Buckstein is going to talk about clinical trials. So rituximab was a little bit of a toxicity freebie in that it, in general, didn't make the side effects of chemotherapy much worse, except on the day you get the drug. So it can be a little bit tough. Rituximab is a protein. It's an antibody, and it's a human protein, but it's not your protein. You didn't make it. A biotech company made it. So infusion reactions, I think, because of that, are quite common. Your body recognizes that this protein doesn't belong to it, and certain things happen after when the drug is infused. So the first few days, or the first dose of rituximab, the treatment is quite long. It takes 5 or 6 hours, sometimes longer, because people experience a lot of unpleasant things, fevers and hives and chills, and you just feel kind of yucky. Your blood pressure might go down. That's all manageable. The nurses are now pretty comfortable with all of this. They recognize when it's going to happen, and they can deal with it. You might have to be there for a while. And oddly enough, unlike if you had penicillin and got a rash, and your doctor gave it to you again, you get a rash again. Eventually, your doctor would stop giving you penicillin. But if we give this medication again and again, these infusion reactions tend to disappear in the vast majority of people, at least. So it's given very slowly for the first few treatments, and then as time goes on, the treatments are shorter and shorter. At least I hope if you've been coming to our hospital, that's actually what's been happening, but I don't know that for sure. We were charged with talking a little bit about quality of life and things like what to expect while you're on treatment. And so these are some of the expectations while people are on chemotherapy. Doxorubicin causes hair loss, even eyebrows and hair in other places. The nausea and vomiting is, people think of nausea and vomiting and hair loss when they think about chemotherapy, but nausea and vomiting these days should be controllable. There are very good antiemetic drugs that should stop vomiting and largely control nausea. So if you've been getting on dancitron and granisetron, that generally works. If it's not working for you, then you have to take this other stuff called a prepotent, which works in a different way. It's quite effective for this particular chemotherapy recipe. And really, if nausea and vomiting is not controlled the first time around, we've been adding this. Unfortunately, aprepitant is not actually covered by the provincial formula, and it's pretty expensive. It's probably better not to throw up. Yeah, just FYI.
Thanks for the tip.
I'm not completely incented to this. I have a few patients that have thrown up in my examining room, so I get it. I don't wear cologne. It wasn't me. So it's unpleasant. We talk a lot about fatigue, and I feel like I've become an exercise evangelist, even though I'm not much of an exercise person. So fatigue is ubiquitous now. Now that nausea and vomiting are not as high on the list of things that trouble people, fatigue and memory and concentration have been. So this gets a lot better with exercise. The first group of people who demonstrated this were actually women with breast cancer who were getting adjuvant chemotherapy for breast cancer. The chemotherapy drugs were largely the same, and 45 minutes or an hour of walking every day reduced fatigue scores, allowed people to control their weight. It was actually quite effective in in women with breast cancer. But fatigue was actually the thing that seemed to improve the most. I think the benefits of exercise to fatigue are much greater than the expectations if we gave people transfusions or other drugs that would raise their hemoglobin. This is not tied to your hemoglobin. It's not tied to red cells. It's tied to stuff that the chemotherapy does to you. And there's a specifically a study in lymphoma patients done in Alberta that looked at a specific prescription of an amount of exercise, you know, using an exercise bike. So they had to go to a gym and ride an exercise bike. But 3 times a week on the bike was actually better than any kind of ad hoc prescription of exercise that the doctor could provide. So you don't have to join a gym. You don't have to buy an exercise bike. You just have to take somebody for a walk every day. And the other thing is fever. So we ask you to monitor your temperature. You have to have a thermometer to your home. It has to work. Because in the middle week of your 3 weeks of chemotherapy, that's when the white blood cell count is lowest. The white blood cells, as John pointed out this morning, are key to fighting off infection, and we don't see the effects of that until about 7 to 10 days after the chemotherapy. So if your temperature is over 38.3 or 101.5, if you have an old thermometer, you have to get a blood test, even if it's on Sunday afternoon. You have to go to the Emerge. You shouldn't go to a walk-in clinic and get some antibiotics. We monitor heart function because of the fact that some of the drugs can affect heart function over time. Having numb hands and feet from vincristine is a troublesome side effect for many people. We used to ask people how they did with jar tops and bra straps and zippers, but now we just ask people if they're able to text or can you use your BlackBerry. And we'd really hear about it. It's okay if you can't actually do up a... Anyway. it's a more sort of modern question to ask. And difficulty with memory and concentration. These are in no particular order. I just remembered this one. I'd forgotten, and I put it in here. So again, this problems with memory and concentration are quite common in people on chemotherapy. I just told you that actually the people who have studied exercise have noticed that this complication or this side effect, this seems to be a bit better as well. A lot of things have gotten better with exercise, curiously. But this is a transient effect, we think. When in longitudinal studies of women who are breast cancer survivors, when they develop problems with chemo brain, memory and concentration, over time all of those things return to normal, or at least back to their baseline. But it can be a little disconcerting when you're forgetting things and you're usually pretty sharp. It should get better. So there's some other important things as well, just to before I finish up, about that are going to have an impact on quality of life. So we had a discussion yesterday, a very good presentation about fertility preservation. Doctors are not particularly good at remembering that the drugs we prescribe can affect fertility. Ellen Greenblatt, who runs the fertility program at Mount Sinai, said, men are easy, men are simple. The solution is not difficult to imagine about what to do with that. Make a sperm donation. But the consequences are quite different for women in terms of fertility preservation options. It's much more complicated, requires a bit more discussion, takes longer, and the fertility outcomes are different as well. So depending on age, fertility may still be preserved despite the chemotherapy we're using in men. Fertility is usually lost because of the nature of the drugs we're doing. So this is a conversation that can take a while, and everybody has to remember to do it. So one of the quality of life things that frequently comes up is, so am I going to be able to go to school, and can I go to work, and do all of this while I'm getting chemotherapy? And my general answer to that is yes, but it depends. It depends on how important your job is. It depends on the nature of your work. Do you have, there's a lot of variables that fit into there. It's the worst scenario is having to go back to a job that you don't like because you don't have an alternative, because you don't have disability insurance. But certainly, for those who find the thought of not working unappealing, or if work is therapeutic because it makes you not think about the fact that you have to have chemotherapy every 3 weeks, then anything is possible. It's best to have a flexible employer. You can certainly go out in public. You can go to restaurants. You can go to the theater. My own view is I don't think that the risk to you in going out in the public if you're on chemotherapy is as bad as you might think it is. It's probably not a good idea for people to sequester themselves and avoid everybody. Stay away from people who are obviously sick. Sit at the back of the movie theater. Take a taxi instead of the TTC. But I think realistically, we will tell you that most of the infections that arise in people on chemotherapy arise from the bacteria that live in your own body. And you can't change that. So that's why where the thermometer comes in. And there are some specific recommendations about immunization that generally would be given to you after the treatment is finished. And I think John's going to talk a little bit about late effects. And the only thing that I can tell you is to repeat the infection control mantra at Princess Margaret Hospital, which is everybody should get a flu shot. Influenza vaccine is not dangerous. Sometimes it's not all that effective, but influenza is much worse in people who are on chemotherapy and those who are not. So it's a relatively simple intervention, and we recommend it to everybody who's on chemotherapy. It doesn't work particularly well, as John did a study of influenza of H1N1 vaccine in a couple of years ago, and H1N1 vaccine didn't work particularly well in people with lymphoma, but nonetheless, it's been what's been recommended. So in terms of treatment outcome, they're quite broad, but they're quite good. I guess the best way to describe this would be, that's why we use that IPI score. That's why we collect those little details about not just the kind of lymphoma, but performance status and sites of disease. Because people who have low scores, we don't have very many of those variables. The length of the probability of being cured is very high, or remaining relapse-free for a really long time. And the more of those variables you have, the less likely the treatment is to be successful. These variables, of course, don't describe things perfectly. We now realize that there are cytogenetic changes, molecular changes in tumor cells that can still happen in people who have favorable IPI scores. And the results of the treatment in those patients is not particularly good. So we're learning more and more about what drives lymphomas. Now we have to learn how to deal with those lymphomas that are driven by a different set of genes than the average person with diffuse large cell lymphoma. Remission rates are lower in older people. They're lower in certain subtypes of T-cell lymphomas. But in general, I think that we've learned that chemotherapy supplemented by rituximab is very effective. So what happens if your first treatment doesn't work? And that's a difficult question to talk about in a forum like this. What happens if your treatment doesn't work? So for younger patients, a stem cell transplant, as John mentioned, is still considered to be the best option. We don't believe that there's anything to support using a stem cell source of stem cells from a brother or a sister or an unrelated donor. Those are allogeneic stem cell transplant. For the kind of lymphoma I've just been describing, it's not a more effective treatment. So we use a stem cell transplant is really a big dose of chemotherapy supported by the person's own stem cells, just as John described in Hodgkin lymphoma. This, again, only responds well if the only achieves the goal of a second remission, a long remission, if the lymphoma is responding to a second chemotherapy recipe. We've done a lot of work at our center looking at what those recipes might be. So when the treatment stops working, or it doesn't work, when R-CHOP has failed you, there's a lot of other things that can be done. But I think the clarifications of the goals of those treatments is really the most important part of the conversation. It's not the list of things that are out there that could be done. It's really about what they will accomplish in terms of disease control and symptom control. So we're not talking about curative treatment sometimes. Sometimes the reason why this is a difficult conversation is because we're not talking about the things we talked about the first time. When the first time you see the doctor with aggressive lymphoma, there's discussion about, am I going to go into remission? Am I going to be cured? This conversation is very different. It's about what all these things can do for you. And to me, it's not so important what the list of things available chemotherapy drugs are. It's what they can accomplish. So single agents are often used. Combination treatment is sometimes used, although we don't use a lot of it because it has more side effects. Local radiation, I think, is very important. And Rena is going to talk about clinical trials because I think that's one of the things that's obviously made clinical trials made lymphoma treatment better in the first place. See previous discussion about rituximab. So clinical trials to us are fundamental for how we're going to improve the statistics that we have to give in talks like this a few years from now. But really the most important part of that discussion about what to do is what are the goals and what's achievable and what do you want to do. So those are long clinic visits. I think that's my last slide. It wasn't a very upbeat slide. I think I had a slide that said something like, I think that it's very clear to us that lymphoma outcomes are substantially better than they were 10 or 15 years ago. And I look forward to Rena's talk about how we're going to continue to make them better in the future. Well, thank you for your attention.